Hi, this is Tony Coomer, and welcome to the Set It Southern podcast. Thank you for downloading Set It Southern podcast number 2. Today I have an interview with Derek Webb. As most of you know, Derek Webb is a recording artist based out of Nashville. His most recent CD is called The Ringing Bell, and we reviewed that CD song by song at Set It Southern. You can also find out more about Derek Webb at his website, derekwebb.com. Love to hear your feedback on these interviews. If you can leave a comment at Set It Southern, or you can shoot me an email, tonycoomer@gmail.com. That's TonyKummer at gmail.com. One other note, Set It Southern podcast is now in iTunes. So if you're into iTunes, you can go there, search for Set It Southern, and get us automatically through your iTunes. And now our interview with Derek Webb. Derek, thanks again for meeting with us. I'm excited to drive down here and get to know you a little bit. Just to start off, can you tell me a little bit about how you came to Christ?
Oh, yeah. Kicking and screaming, I think, would portray it pretty accurately. I was in high school, summer between my sophomore and junior year of high school. And it was actually at a Young Life property in Colorado. I grew up in the South and, you know, grew up in a house going to church. But it was really, I mean, like in a lot of Southern homes, it was just kind of a cultural, you know, mm-hmm. thing that we did. I think I was probably following a girl to this Young Life camp. It was the only, I think that was the reason I went.
Yeah.
Because I had been in bands all through high school and junior high and took that real seriously. And the band that I was in, at the time broke up because we were driving to Baylor University. And all the guys in the band were older than I was. And we were driving up to play some show and got in this really bad wreck. And so it kind of shut our band down for the summer. And I was home. I didn't have anything else to do. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have gone. And so I went to Frontier Ranch in Buena Vista. And Jesus really kind of pursued me and kind of caught me up there. But all the stuff you're supposed to do, if that happened, like if you make a decision or whatever, mm-hmm. Or the stuff that they kind of do at a Young Life camp where they have like a night at the end where you kind of stand up and you kind of say something or whatever. I didn't stand up. I didn't say anything. Like I didn't actually say anything to anybody until I got back home. That was kind of my conversion experience, you know, or whatever. But then, you know, I feel like I've had, you know, not literal conversion experiences, but like ten other times over the last whatever it's been 20 years, you mm-hmm. know, that have been kind of moments of enlightenment, you know, that seem to me moments where you kind of take hold of the gospel a little more deeply, or it takes more deeply a hold of you, and you feel like you just surely didn't even understand it before that moment. And I've had those moments, quite a few sure. of those since.
Wow.
So, but that's kind of, that was the moment, I guess, you know.
So did you get involved, you went back and you got involved in a church or a youth group, or what happened next?
I got involved with Young Life. And yeah. And over the years, I mean, I've, you know, not everywhere, but my experience with Young Life has been, and not even necessarily with my particular Young Life club in Northwest Houston, but that they don't do a tremendous job of kind of mainlining people back into the local church.
Sure.
I think, you know, it Young Life was kind of my church. Monday night clubs were kind mm-hmm. of my church for a long time, and which was great. And I was getting a lot of good things. I was getting, you know, a little bit of teaching and a lot of great fellowship, but I wasn't, you know, really partaking in the means of grace by any means. Mm. Really fully there. But I did, by the end of high school, followed some of my friends to a few different churches. But I didn't really find a good church until years later. But I didn't really understand. No one really taught me anything about the necessity of gathering regularly with the body of believers,
sure.
you know, under the guidance and authority of a, mm-hmm. you know, of a good pastor and elders. I mean, I didn't really understand any of that. Yeah. So there was, I don't really know. It would have been a miracle if I'd ended up going to church in high school, because I don't really know why I would have gone.
Yeah.
Like, no one really told me why, any good reason why I should go, other than, well, I guess that's one of a handful of places I could gather and go have some fellowship and be with some believers. But it didn't seem all that important to me at the time. So the fact that I went at all is kind of a miracle.
Yeah.
But I did go.
Okay. That's now, for a while you were somehow connected with either First Baptist Houston or Second Baptist, was it?
Well, it was Second Baptist
Second
Houston.
Second Baptist.
But it was kind of both, because okay. Second Baptist is where Cliff Young, who was one of my best friends, and we played in Cadence together for
okay, sure.
10 or 11 years. His dad is the pastor there.
Okay.
So I got a job there. You know, I needed a job, and his dad helped me get a job there. And I worked for a lot of the years that I worked while Cadence was trying to get started, I worked at Second Baptist.
Okay.
But Cadence was also the house band at Metro Bible Study in Houston, which was at First Baptist.
First Baptist.
But it wasn't really affiliated with First Baptist. That's just where it was.
Okay.
And that was before worship music was the big industry that it is now.
Sure.
Back when a band could play worship music on the side and not have to be a worship band.
Yeah.
but anyway, so yeah, so there was a connection to both churches.
Okay. So were you a Southern Baptist then?
I mean...
Officially at some point, did you...
I did join Second Baptist Church.
Okay.
So I was a member there for some years. It was hard when anyone who's ever worked at a church can tell you that it's hard to be behind the scenes and work in, you know, at a church where you're trying to worship. It's really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of when you're in the minutia of all the details of the lights going up and down and the music starting and stopping.
Yeah.
So that's where I was a member for a lot of years, but when I was there for church, I was usually working,
mm-hmm.
But at night, Cliff's brother Ben, who to this day is a real hero of mine, he did a service, and he kind of involved us in the creating of the service called the Logos service, which
okay.
is really bad Greek, I know, pronunciation wise, but a tremendous, really progressive service, and
mm-hmm.
Where he taught like exegetically and really kind of historically, and we took the sacraments every week, and we sang hymns, which was really kind of, I guess in a Baptist church, not unheard of, but it was before a lot of the stuff that's happening now was happening.
Yeah.
And so it was very progressive and very reformed too, because Ben, while he was Baptist and in this, you know, kind of kingdom of a Baptist church, you know, there at Second Baptist, just a huge congregation,
yeah.
and a huge compound there in that part of Houston, had gotten really into kind of more Reformed thought, and he and a few other of the leadership there at the church, and it was having a really profound effect on the community of Second Baptist Church, and so just in a few little spots, there started to be this kind of budding Reformed kind of little movements happening around. And between Ben and a guy named Glenn Lucky, who has gone on to do some tremendous work, both online and writing himself, and a handful of other guys, Robert Hurley, who's also still at Second Baptist Church, they were a really profound influence on Cademan's, which was my community at the time, and really got us into Reformed thought, and really were the ones who were sliding those books across the table to us, and kind of whispering to us in the back halls of Second Baptist Church, and something about being part of Logos and getting that regular teaching, and he would go through, and I mean, it was really a formidable time, you know, and so I have been to thank for a lot of that.
Okay, great. Thanks for that.
How
would you just briefly summarize the gospel?
What a great question. I guess I'd probably, my instinct is to say that it is Jesus coming, living, dying, being resurrected, and his inaugurating the already and the not yet of all things being restored to himself, and that happening by way of himself, the being made right of all things, that process both beginning and being a reality in the lives and hearts of believers, and yet a day coming when it'll be more fully realized. But the good news, the gospel, the speaking of the good news, is the news of his kingdom coming, the inaugurating of his kingdom coming.
Okay,
that's my instinct.
Yeah, it's good. got a couple questions about you as a musician.
Oh,
I know
yeah.
that's a big part of your life, from what I understand.
yeah.
Just, Derek, why do you make music?
Because I can't not do it. It's just the only thing I really know how to do. It's the only, I've done it since I was, 5 years old. I mean, I've just always been compelled to music, and it's just all I've ever done. I mean, I've always known I would have to do it. When I was in high school, I determined at one point that if I couldn't, I started to kind of examine the odds of making my living playing music professionally, which I knew were not very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'll work in a music store. I'll sell guitars to people. I'll sell records. I mean, I don't know what I'll do, but I knew I would have to work in music somehow.
Okay.
Because it's just, it's just all I really know how to do. I mean, I don't know what else I would do. And in the times in my life where I've thought that I'd really like to do something else, which is often, because music's a really hard living. And I think about going in and getting a straight job, which is a really great thought to me.
Mm.
Like having a regular job where there's regular hours and a really defined thing I'm supposed to be doing for those hours, and then I can leave that job and go do something else.
Yeah.
And then I get a regular paycheck for it. When I have those thoughts, they're great, until I start to think about what I would do, and then I just can't come up with anything. I just don't know. I mean, the reason that I play music and have been playing music for whatever it is now, 15 years professionally, is because I just can't come up with anything else that I could possibly do. And I swear if I could think of something else, I'd probably be doing it.
Yeah.
And most of my friends, and that's kind of the story, people come up to me and ask me, like, I want to play music for a living, what's your advice? My advice is typically to ask them if there's anything else they can imagine themselves doing, anything else that they feel like they can do, like they're gifted that they could do.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is something else, then go do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because honestly, like, you'll thank me later. But you'll find that if there's anything else you could fall back on and do, you will go do that before the whole thing is said and done. Because music can be pretty grueling. Even when you can have some kind of moderate success at it, it's really hard. And you're second-guessing yourself and looking over your shoulder every day. And it's just like, it's a really hard job.
You know, the advice you just gave is almost identical to the advice young pastors get.
Is that right?
If you talk to a senior pastor,
you want to be a pastor,
say,
yeah, if
you're called
to
the ministry, they say almost the exact same thing.
Interesting.
That is interesting.
Well, and I can see how that would be a really difficult job too, and I can see how it would look like kind of a really romantic job, and some this great idea, but the reality of it is really difficult.
Yeah.
And
Do you understand your role as a musician? Do you see yourself as, an artist? Do you see yourself as kind of a prophet? Do you see yourself as—is this just your calling or your addiction? I mean, what is this thing?
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I probably wouldn't refuse probably almost any of those things. But primarily, I see it as my vocation, playing music.
Mm-hmm.
It's my job. I'm a singer-songwriter. I feel like it's my job to write and to sing songs to the best of my abilities with excellence and as far as I can. That's my job.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I feel like I'm gifted to do... I mean, that's a job a lot of people have.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, more specifically, I feel like I have particular gifts that I'm still trying to kind of sort out and figure out how it is that I can use them to do my job best.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel like, over the years, that I've determined part of my job to be an agitator.
Yeah.
And just because I have a knack for... pinpointing things that seem obvious that don't really get addressed that I feel like need addressing,
mm-hmm.
and then I have a real compulsion to kind of go after those things, whatever those things are, and they're not typically things that I'm even necessarily that interested in. I wasn't really ever that interested in the church,
mm-hmm.
in the idea of the church, the idea of the institution.
Sure.
And yet I got interested in it and felt like there were a lot of aspects of it that weren't really getting discussed that I thought were important to me. And so as I was sorting through that, I ended up writing a record about that and kind of talking a lot about that and dealing a lot with that. But it wasn't necessarily – it wasn't like that would have been the first thing I wanted to go make music about. And some of the compulsion towards more social or political ideas is really the same way. I never saw myself as making records like that or writing songs like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the context of using the gifts that I have in order to do the job that's before me, these are the things that I've kind of been compelled towards. But I really, it for me, it more comes down to, like, I feel like it's really important, and I don't really see anyone else who's willing to do it. Mm-hmm. But I really feel like it needs to get done. And I feel like that there are conversations that need to be going on that just aren't going on, and I don't see anybody else lining up for the job. And I don't think I'm the best to do it. And I don't think I'm the best equipped to do some of these things. But, you know, but here I am, doing them. In terms of like, I mean, over my career up to this point, the word prophet or kind of prophetic, mm-hmm. I've heard a number of times. And I don't shy away from that word, but it doesn't mean to me what it means to some people. I think that artists in general in the church have a real burden to speak prophetically. And mm-hmm. what I, but I have a really broader idea when I use a word like that. I don't mean like in the prophetic tradition in as much as I mean a burden to really radically tell the truth to people, mm-hmm. to the expense of their careers or reputations if they must. Because mm-hmm. I think artists are just in such a unique role in our culture. Mm-hmm. And so I think especially our artists who are followers of Jesus have such a unique position that they can really say things and it can go places where other people can't go and other mediums can't take it. And so I just think it's really, in terms of kingdom building, I think that artists have such a particular and peculiar role and really need to take it seriously, especially when there's the whole struggle of kind of art and commerce and then mm-hmm. religion, and it compounds. It's really difficult. So it's hard, so it's hard for artists to really be truth tellers because their job depends on them also being liked.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, one of the themes I keep hearing again and again in your music is this whole struggle between, I feel like I'm called to say things, but at the same time, I'm selling the stuff.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a salesman.
But the reality really is that you sell it.
Yeah.
And having to kind of strike the balance, if there is one, and having to kind of come to grips with, to some extent, kind of, you know, people talk about being a fool for the Lord. Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of I'm trying to come to grips with being a hypocrite for the Lord. I feel like that's part of my role because I'm having to address things and issues and topics that I don't do well and I'm not right about, but I feel like need addressing nonetheless, mm-hmm. and having to just be ready to say, yeah, I'm a total hypocrite. I don't do any of these things well. I don't have any of this right. But I feel like it's my job to address this, and I feel mm-hmm. like if at any point I say anything true, it condemns me as much as it condemns anybody. Like, I mean, I'm having to try to get out of the way of it just like everybody else, but I can't help the fact that the work is before me to do. Mm-hmm. That is kind of a weird, you know, because art and commerce is a hard marriage, as they say, but art, commerce, and religion is kind of
terrible.
A doomed marriage.
Yeah. Yeah.
If not illegal, because it's three people getting married. But anyway, so that's always been kind of a hard balance or whatever to try to figure out.
What do you make of all this? You know, maybe one of the first stories I heard about Cademan's Call, there was something about a T-shirt that was being sold at the concert.
Oh,
and,
right.
And you guys were, like, offended. That was way back. I don't even know where I heard that.
It was a ways back, yeah.
It seems like there's this whole issue in American Christianity where people can get rich off Jesus. I mean, straight up, you can get rich off Jesus.
Jesus is big business. There's
I mean,
no doubt about it.
What do you make of that? I mean, as a Christian, how do you...
Oh, well, it's really disheartening. I mean, because when you're in Christian culture the way that I've been, just being in a band or whatever, like you end up seeing like the big Christian festivals. You end up really seeing kind of the underbelly of it, like just the really despicable side of it. You know, you these big conventions where you go down on the convention floor and people have just thought of everything you could ever imagine to sell in Jesus' name.
Yeah.
Every different way you can brand and market Jesus, they've thought of it, and they have found the line and they have run across it, you know, in hopes of kind of turning a profit. And some people do it with really good intention, and some people, I mean, it's not like, I mean, there's a lot of gray in here. I mean, I'm not saying that the whole thing is bad.
Yeah.
You know, I am constantly looking at like technology and music as ways to kind of communicate my ideas about the mm-hmm. way I look at the world. And I think people who have gifts in business and have a clever mind for marketing probably are doing the same thing. But sometimes they run a little too far. But it's really hard. It's really hard to see some of that, and also to be in the culture to where you feel like you're constantly just gnawing on the hand that kind of feeds you, you know, is a really weird, you know, position to be in. But But it's been really hard, and you kind of wish that the whole thing would go away. You just wish that there was no such thing as kind of the Christian subculture that we have in America. I just feel like does so much more harm than good. And that could be like a 4 or 5 hour deal, discussion just in and of itself.
Yeah, I was thinking back off Mockingbird, Zeros and Ones.
Oh,
song,
yeah.
Zeros and Ones. And that was when I had that CD. In my life, I was full-time ministry. I was in my first year of it, but I was, you know, maybe 6 months, 7 months in. And I just felt like there was something quantitatively different for getting paid to do what I love to do. I love to share Jesus, love to minister the word. I love to do that, but there was a different kind of pressure because I was getting paid to do it, you know?
Right.
And I struggled with that song. That kind of spoke to me.
That's good.
Where
that's
I was at there.
What that's about, yeah. And But you know what's hard is it's complicated when there's the spiritual aspect to it, you know, with like a ministry oriented vocation, which mine I don't think is. I don't really consider my job ministry oriented. I don't consider it ministry. But but for my friends who do that kind of work, like what you're talking about, I can see how that would be even compounded. But what's interesting is I feel like you'd probably run into that with any job.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I have friends who are artists who are real purists about it. And when they started making their full-time wage from it, they felt really differently about it. And it was this weird kind of, you know, a similar sounding kind of thing. But I think the spirituality of it makes it all more complicated. And that's why I'm more offended by bad Christian pop music than I am offended by bad pop music.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the spiritual side of it. It offends me more.
Sure.
I mean, like, it definitely takes it to another level when kind of the Christian spirituality gets attached to it, makes the whole thing kind of more is riding on it, and it makes it more kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's a question for you. Back several years ago when you kind of left Cademan's Call, went out on your own, there were some rumors floating around. I don't even know the full story. Something about the prayer of Jabez at a conference where you guys... You feel comfortable sharing any of that story?
Yeah.
I'm not even sure. Maybe that's out there already, but I haven't.
Well, I feel like I have spoken enough about it to where it's probably pretty well documented at this point. So I totally don't mind telling that story. I mean, I'm a professional autobiographer, so I don't mind telling any story. like, there's really nothing off limits.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, Cademan's was, I don't remember what year this would have been, maybe 99, maybe 2000. Oh, no, it would have had to have been after that. It would have had to have been, I guess, 2001, maybe, 2000, 2001. And Cademan's was in Atlanta, the CBA conference, Christian Booksellers, which is a really big deal. And bands go there to kind of sell whatever they've got that's new, trying to get it into the stores, you know, trying to get the stores excited. And, I mean, authors do it. You know, it's just one of those things. And so Cademan's was at the CBA conference, and it was our first night, and we were scheduled to play some music after Bruce Wilkinson spoke. And Bruce is the guy who wrote Prayer of Jabez, along with a lot of other things, Walk Through the Bible series. I mean, you know, he's done some really good work too. And anyways, so I hadn't heard a lot about the book other than the fact that it sold, like, at that point, maybe 6 or 7 or 8 million copies.
Wow.
Which for a book is outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a lot of friends, you know, who are... I'm looking at a Jars of Clay plaque over there, and Jars are friends of mine, and they certainly have fallen prey to being so popular that people are suspicious of them and hate them.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly don't want to be that guy who's, you know, just because something's popular, let's criticize it, and, you know, and let's assume the worst. And so I was really looking forward to going and seeing Bruce speak and seeing what he had to say about the book, and, you know, I was really looking forward to it. What I didn't realize is that part of the night up until Bruce spoke was kind of the Prayer of Jabez themed night.
Oh,
Jeff Moore, who had written, a track for the Prayer of Jabez album that had just come out.
Okay,
and a handful of other people who'd written songs on that album had performed before Bruce, and then there was Bruce, and then there was us, which I guess was kind of a separate part of the night, but it flowed right into it.
Yeah,
and which I wasn't nervous about until I saw Bruce actually speak. And he got up, and for what was supposed to be a half hour, I guess was about an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And he just talked and talked and talked and talked about the Prayer of Jabez and about this book and about this wild success that it had and about basically this formula that he had discovered that was like rubbing a genie in a bottle. I mean, and he spoke about it in terms of like, it doesn't matter what your posture is towards Jesus. It doesn't matter what your relationship is towards Jesus. You can be of some radically different world religion. You can be, but if you will commit to praying this prayer and do it for this amount of days, that it's, I mean, just like it says in the back of the book, it's the prayer that God cannot say no to. He must answer this prayer.
Wow.
And he told all these Jabez success stories, these people, these journalists who were Jewish, who were Muslim, who were agnostic, who he gave the Jabez challenge, as he said to them, and said, you know, well, you may not believe me, but just try it. Just do it for 30 days. It doesn't matter what you think about Jesus. It doesn't matter what you think about Christianity. Just try this. Pray it for 30 days, and then you tell me if it doesn't work for you. You tell me if you're not seeing whatever it is that you want multiplied in the success that you're looking for, and, you know, doors starting to open. And literally for an hour and 15 minutes did not once mention the name of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not a big JPM guy. I mean, I've been in music for a long time. I'm not counting the Jesuses per minute in the pop okay. music I'm listening to.
Sure.
You know, I don't care about that sort of thing. But when you're talking about God bestowing the blessings, you know, all of the you know, especially when he talks about, it says in the back of the book or on the flap of the book anyways, and he certainly said it that night, wouldn't you hate to one day get to heaven and to find out that there were all these great blessings that God had wanted to give to you, but that he didn't give you? And why? Because you never prayed this prayer. You never unlocked the secret to God kind of flooding your life with these blessings.
Wow.
You know, and which made me really feel bad for all of those who had walked with Jesus and lived with him, all the apostles and all of his disciples who didn't have the great benefit of living until the 21st century when they could get their hands on a book like Bruce's and unlock those blessings.
Sure.
It really made me sad for them. And anyway, and how sad Paul, who wrote two thirds of the New Testament, must have been when he got to heaven and realized the floodgates of blessings that never were opened
yeah.
into his life, because again
he had a hard
pay
life.
The $12
sure.
to buy the book. But anyways, so at the conclusion of this, you know, so what I was saying is it's troubling to hear about God bestowing all the blessings you know, of his kingdom into your life, and yet to have no mention of Jesus or any connection to Jesus in that economy or transaction,
sure.
which was really troubling to us. And he got done, and at the end of his kind of speech about this, issued what was essentially an altar call, a challenge. And I didn't mention there was maybe 3,000 people in this huge ballroom listening to this, sitting at tables, having enjoyed a great meal. And these people are basically made up of all the people across the United States who stock Christian bookstores with goods.
Mm.
That's who we're all making our pitch to this particular
sure.
evening. So these are important people. And these are important people in the lives of local people who come in to find out what it is they should be reading
yeah,
and
for
what,
recommendations.
You know,
sure.
For recommendations. What's sitting on the shelf. And so he issues this altar call of like, who here wants me to pray over you that you will be faithful in your praying of the prayer every day for 30 days? You know, who wants to you know, basically like come up to the front, I'll pray over you that you will faithfully do it. Mm. And I thought, okay, finally justice. Finally we'll see no one get up and everyone kind of sit in protest to this, you know, to this ridiculous bit of teaching. And it's apparently so popular. And so he issues this challenge, and to my great astonishment, literally two-thirds of the room get up, arm in arm. It looks like a Billy Graham crusade,
wow.
just weeping, moving to the front, just crowded all around the stage. And he prays over them and on God's behalf says, you know, that I can't wait to see next year at the CBA conference how God has doubled the income of your store, has doubled the physical size of your store. You will have local Christian radio stations supporting your store and giving you radio spots. And I mean, you know, like this is going to happen for you. I mean, it can't not happen. You know, if you commit to doing this and if you do it every day, this is what's going to happen. I can promise you on God's behalf. And these people, you know, felt so good and went and sat down. And this is what we're following.
Mm.
You know, not only this kind of amazing, kind of terrible bit of teaching, but to great success in the room. So how in the world, what do you say? What do you do to follow that? So my label, Caden's label, were sitting around us, and the band were all had, you know, he'd gone way over his time. We didn't even know if we were still going to play at this point. They had half of them kind of walked out and walked around. And I'm sitting there like Johnny Bench on the edge of my seat, staring at the stage, like couldn't wait to get up there.
Yeah.
And the label were very concerned because they saw that look in my eye, and I'd done things like this before, and so they were worried. You know, they're like, listen, you can't go up there and say anything about this. You realize, because they love this guy, and this is, you know, 80% of the income of their stores right now, and we're trying to sell in a record to these same people. So don't go up there and piss somebody off. You just you can't. You know, so they were worried.
Yeah.
And so we got up there. And as it happened, we were playing Thankful first, but normally it starts with this big trash can thing, whatever, this big rhythm. We didn't have trash cans because we had flown to Atlanta. And so I had to start the song by myself. And so the band was looking at me to start the song. So I had this kind of awkward moment where this kind of pregnant pause where I could say something. And I did. I didn't say much, but I just wanted to distance us from all this. So I went up and said, you know, listen, this is our first time to hear any of this. I don't know anything about the Prayer Jabez. We're not part of the Prayer Jabez record that apparently has been promoted up to this point. This is my first time. You know, we don't know anything about this Prayer Jabez thing, and I don't know what I can say about that. Yeah. But what I can, but this next song I think is a song about the gospel, and so maybe, I don't know, maybe you'll see some contrast between that and what you've been hearing over the last 2 hours. I can't really speak to that, but we're going to play the song for you. So here it goes, you know, kind of deal. And so we play Thankful, and Bruce is sitting at the table, like right at the feet, right at the foot of the stage. And so it was a really strange kind of moment. And then literally went back to the hotel room that night and wrote Wedding Dress.
Oh, wow.
And which was the first song of what evolved into my first solo record, which was a record that I never thought I would ever make. I mean, I never had any intention or ambition to be a solo artist or make a solo record or anything like that. So that literally was the moment that kind of shifted the tracks for me.
Okay.
You know, and I found myself going into kind of doing this.
Wow. So you didn't pray the prayer?
I didn't.
Okay. See, I thought that's where this whole story was going. You prayed the prayer and you got your own record deal.
But I'm thinking about it nowadays because I've never managed to sell very many records.
Oh.
And the only thing I haven't tried
is the prayer.
So I don't know. If you see, if this next year I have some kind of wild success and 7 million records,
I'll know what happened.
Ask me again, and you might know what happened.
Great. So now, so that's how that kind of launched you on your own. And now, just recently, like last month, they announced you're coming back with Cademans for the for the tour and for this record coming out. Now, is that kind of a permanent deal, or is it kind of a wait and see deal, or what are the plans there?
It's just like a. I mean, it's the whole thing happens organically, and it wasn't planned. It wasn't like any kind of a grand scheme. I mean, so I can't really say with a lot of, you know, I don't know exactly what we're doing, and that's kind of the way we've handled it up to this point. Is like they left their other label, got on the same label that I'm with, and so it just kind of was this organic thing. We were like, you know, like, it would be fun. Why not do a record together? Like, why not do it?
Yeah.
And, you know, they're trying to kind of regain the trust of some of the Cademans fans after a few years of a little more label pressure than is necessary and the effects that can have on a band's art. And so we thought that might be a fun thing to do. So when we got together and worked on the record, we were like, okay, let's not think about what we're doing. Let's not think about what this means or what this is or who am I in this situation. Let's just do it. If something good comes of it, then we'll deal with it. Because maybe it won't work. You know, maybe we'll try it and nothing, you know. Mm-hmm. But it did. It was really fun. And I think a really cool record came out of it. And so now we have the burden of trying to kind of put a name on it and trying to figure out what it is and what am I doing and what's my role in this. Mm. And so the way we're looking at it is it's just for this one record, this one tour, and then but I have my career. That's my full-time job. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and that's my first priority. I don't know. I mean, I can't say completely for sure that we won't do anything beyond this record and tour. But our intention is to just for this record and to do a tour and to have a blast, and then for them to kind of have their career as they have had up to this point.
Sure.
So yeah, who knows what's going on. It should be really fun, though. February, we'll be out for
yeah, I think you guys are going to come.
Doing shows together.
I was looking. I heard rumors that you guys are going to come up near me, so I'll try.
It'll be really fun, man. There's a lot of songs that we'll probably play that neither of us have played in a long time. And just to be up on stage together again, there's no telling what'll happen. It'll be really fun.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for listening to Set It Southern Podcast number 2. We have 43 more minutes with Derek. I'm going to share with you guys next week in podcast number 3. To find out more about Derek Webb, you can go to derekwebb.com. This is Tony Coomer, and thanks for listening.
Don't want the song, I want a jingle. I love you, Lord, but don't hear a single. And the truth is nearly impossible to rhyme. And I know the songs with all the hooks. I know some lies to sell some books. So grab them.